Reflections on Religion and Nationalism, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Historian and statesman Connor Cruz O'Brien is here now to talk about Godland, his study of religion, nationalism, and global politics.
A complex of emotions around family, around blood ties, around sense of common ancestors, around territory, around language, and around religion. They all come into, I think, really every form of nationalism, but in different constellations in each case. They're always around.
Historian Connor Cruz O'Brien, he'll be back in just a moment to discuss Godland, his book about religion and nationalism. Funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the John M. Olin Foundation. Additional support comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. This is the time of year when Americans look back to the country's origins and celebrate the national inheritance. It's also a time when our collective spirit of patriotism takes on something of a religious fervor. Nonetheless, the United States has for the most part managed successfully to balance the forces of religion and nationalism that often lead to political and military flashpoints elsewhere in the world. The reasons for this are, of course, complex, but the work of one historian at the National Humanities Center provides a good starting point toward understanding them. Connor Cruz O'Brien is an historian, educational statesman, United Nations troubleshooter, Irish legislator, and biographer. Among his recent books is The Great Melody, a biographical study of the British philosopher Edmund Burke. Last winter, in the first of a series of autobiographical articles, Connor Cruz O'Brien was pictured on the cover of The Atlantic Monthly, which called him a 20th century witness, the only writer alive today comparable to George Orwell and André Malraux. Over the next 30 minutes, Connor Cruz O'Brien will talk about Godland, his study of religion and nationalism. He says that the combination of these two powerful forces is occasionally benign, but more often dangerous, even lethal. With that in mind, in Godland, he explores the confusion and the conflation of these two ancient impulses, ranging from Old Testament times to the days of Joan of Arc, from Puritan Massachusetts and the American Revolution to the present day. He'll talk about those topics momentarily, but first, Connor Cruz O'Brien begins his discussion with an anecdote about the National Prayer Breakfast and contemporary American politics.
The National Prayer Breakfast was founded by President Eisenhower in 1953. It has been attended annually by the President and the First Lady, by members of the Supreme Court, by members of both houses of Congress, and by the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And this is in a country that separates religion and the state.
Exactly. And when I attended this, I don't know who it was that got me a ticket, because I generally don't move in these circles. But this was during the Reagan presidency, and the president arrived, President First Lady, arrived bang on time at exactly 8 a.m., and then the chairman, who was the chairman of the House Prayer Breakfast Committee, his name was Ralph Regula of Ohio, he got up and he delivered the following prayer, which I took down at the time. It ran as follows. O Lord, help us in the excitement of the presence here among us of the President of the United States to remember also your son, Jesus Christ.
God got kicked upstairs.
Absolutely. I looked around. There are about 5,000 people in that hall in the International Ballroom of the Washington Hilton.
And there was no irony in this.
No trace of irony and no trace of anything, but among the faces looking around, There wasn't a twitch or a lip. This was straight stuff.
Well, I don't know if it goes to nationalism, Connor, but what occurs to me is that, reading between the lines here, we could say that we want to believe in our politicians and make them the focal point of our nationalistic feelings, and yet we want to know the worst about them at the same time.
Yes. Yeah, well, a lot of ambivalence comes into all this. But there is... There's a book which you certainly know, Ernest Lee Tuveson, Redeemer Nation.
Speaking of the United States?
Speaking of the United States.
Uh-huh.
And that impulse is there. And for good or ill, I think it is part of the American national character, American national expectations, that somehow Kissinger, in his recent book, Diplomacy, he links what he calls American exceptionalism and American universalism. Well, exceptionalism is actually the basic idea. There is chosen people.
We're special.
But you're special, but also you have the power to make other people turn good like you. There's this sense of mission.
This is the hem of the robe philosophy.
That's right, and it's good in that the impulse is generally benevolent. You don't want to hate other nations; you want to do them good and fine. But it also leads you into terrible jams.
Indeed.
Like Haiti, Somalia, Bosnia,
Indeed. Name it. Is it a product of human nature, or is it a product of what we call the constructed history that we all look back and read and try to figure out?
It's very much part of human nature, and both the good and the bad. The bonding force. I mean, if you could get rid of nationalism, it would mean that Americans could look at the flag, for example, without feeling anything in particular. That's just a piece of colored bunting. If that happened, America would dissolve into savagely competing ethnic groups. You'd get something like former Yugoslavia, which God forbid. So you can't want nationalism just to go away.
Uh-huh.
It's a bonding force, often for good. And unfortunately, one of the ways we bond together is by bonding against somebody else, which we're seeing. It's something that cannot be managed from outside. If you attempt to manage it from outside, by, for example, you send forces into Bosnia to sort out Bosnia, what happens is your forces are up against people who are motivated by aroused manic nationalism, if you like, as is the case with Serbs and Croats.
Mm-hmm. As one scholar here at the center put it, these are people who take their religion seriously.
That's right. And that's to say, they're motivated not merely to kill, but to die. Your forces put in there for reasons which they don't understand and will understand less and less the more they see of what they've come in to sort out.
Mm.
Well, it'll be like Vietnam. People will say, let's get the hell out of here. Or like Somalia, where essentially one televised picture of a United States soldier being dragged through the streets dead, that ended the U.S. intervention in Somalia. And people ought to draw the lessons from that.
So it's altogether appropriate that your book here, Godland, Reflections on Religion and Nationalism, has a kind of a theological theme that runs through it. We are talking, after all, about the forces that are closest to the human heart and the human emotions.
Yes, that's so. These are very powerful forces, and they have to be treated with respect, even in their negative manifestations. If they have to be taken on, as, for example, the nationalism of Adolf Hitler had to be taken on, you've got to be sure that you're ready to take it on, as America was after Pearl Harbor, but might well not have been before.
You have written in your book, Godland, that the word nationalism and indeed the word religion don't appear in the Hebrew Bible, and yet we look there for a sense of their conflation. Tell me about this.
Yeah. Well, you have in the Hebrew Bible, known to Christians as the Old Testament, you have the basic concepts of a chosen people and a promised land. And these echo all down subsequent history. There's every European nation, and the Americans after them, have seen themselves at some time as a chosen people. And in America, the promised land aspect of it became particularly alive. So this has been going on a long time. There's a tendency to, political scientists in particular, treat nationalism as quite a recent phenomenon beginning in the late 18th century. But things happen to it. For many ages, religion and nationalism went hand in hand. They were almost inseparable, as they are, of course, obviously, in ancestor worship, which is a very old form of religion. But something peculiar does happen to nationalism in the 18th century, and I think this is why political scientists tend to place the beginning there. What happens is that nationalism becomes distinct from religion, takes on a life of its own. And, of course, in the nationalism of the French Revolution, which is very strong, takes an anti-religious form.
Let's save that for just a moment, Connor, and come back to some of these more relatively modern manifestations. Take me back in time to the connection between Jesus and St. Paul and what the Bible refers to as the kingdom of heaven manifesting itself here on terra firma.
Yes. Well, Jesus is the great anti-nationalist. He takes the Jewish tradition from which he comes, and he pushes aside the nationalistic elements, the attachment to land. A very important conversation with the Samaritan woman, who the Samaritans have, of course, their holy mountain. And he tells her to forget about that. There are no holy places on earth.
What about, for example, as we move nationalism forward in time from the Common Era into the Middle Ages? Here we're on the verge of what you were describing a moment ago. That is to say, Christianity, loyalty to homeland, the name Joan of Arc comes to mind.
Yes, yes. Joan of Arc is a very key figure. She's the great, she represents at its maximum intensity the fusion of religion and nationalism. They were the same for her. She said at the very beginning of her mission, in a letter which he dictated to the Duke of Burgundy, who was the rebellious vassal of the King of France, she says to him, "He who makes war on the Holy Kingdom of France makes war on Jesus Christ." So Jesus Christ and the Holy Kingdom of France are the same.
Now those are fighting words.
Well, you can't beat that for fusion of religion and nationalism.
What about youth, the fervor of youth and the emotional wellsprings of nationalism? Is nationalism something that we restrict to young people and not to older people? Here we're talking about Joan of Arc.
Well, she of course was 19 when she when they burned her, partly for being nationalistic in the wrong way. Incidentally, she was of course tried by a court, nominally of her countrymen, but they were her countrymen who were working for the English king. And this shows in the charges against her. One of the charges made against Joan of Arc was that she heard the Saint Catherine and Saint Michael talking. She's asked, "What language do they speak?" And she says, "French." And this is a charge against her, that she is pretending that French is the language spoken in heaven, when everybody knows that the language spoken in heaven is English.
Of course.
So there you have English nationalism in contradiction of French nationalism.
We move from...
And that's the 15th century, so it goes back way beyond the 18th.
Exactly. We move from the time of Christ and St. Paul through the Middle Ages into Anglo-Saxon Protestantism, and what you call, Connor Cruz O'Brien, the intensification of nationalism in Great Britain and North America. Mm-hmm. You've written about three varieties of nationalism. Tell me what they are very briefly, and then we'll talk about the modern world.
Well, I call them chosen people, holy nation, and deified nation. There are really only two examples, fortunately for us all, of deified nation. One is revolutionary France, and the other is Nazi Germany. They put the nation, the German nation, French nation, above everything, above all law. Nothing can stand against the nation.
You cite, my memory is vague here, you cite a letter in which the nation becomes God. It was in an Englishman?
It occurs in various places, but one is an address to of the so-called agitators, who were the leading people in the French Revolution in 1792.
They say the
image of the patrie, the nation, is the only entity which it is permissible to worship. So that puts all the religions in their places, and the patrie is there.
What about modern America, Connor Cruz O'Brien, the anti-communist crusade, Cardinal Spellman taking up the flag of American nationalism? How bad did it get, let's put it that way?
Not as bad as it might have, I think you could say. I think America was fortunate in that the great demagogue, Joe McCarthy, was not really all that smart, he was dumb enough to take on the Pentagon, charging it with being soft on communism and maybe run by communists. He was drunk most of the time, which I think was part of his trouble. So then a very formidable public relations machine, that of the U.S. Armed Forces, took him to the cleaners, and that was the end of that brief reign of terror, but a lot of damage was done in those times.
Wasn't it President Lincoln who said that we are an almost chosen
it
people?
Was,
I
find it beautiful.
Explain that to me.
Beautiful. Because I had ranked the three stages of this thing, chosen people, holy nation, which has been defined as chosen people with tenure, and deified nation. And,
right.
And Lincoln goes below chosen people. He's conscious that there's, you know, you shouldn't be all that pleased with yourself. He makes this stipulation. And that seems to me an ideal temperature for nationalism. Obviously, nationalism has its benign aspects. It has its potentially destructive aspects.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift gears a little bit, Connor Cruz O'Brien. Talk to me about nationalism elsewhere on the globe. In the Third World, for example, you have mentioned Bosnia, the former Yugoslavia. We seem to be living in, as Dickens would put it, the best and the worst of times. We see the threat of communism receding, and yet we see the threat of nationalism on the ascendancy. What do we do?
Nationalism has a tendency to fill gaps when other things fail, as in the period of the French Revolution, when people lost faith in God and in the king. Nationalism came surging in. It filled the gaps left by the fall of communism in the former Soviet Union and in former Yugoslavia. And you can't go out there and sort out nationalism. That's an illusion which I find people are prone in this country, that we can somehow send people in there and change those people into something better.
Oh, no, wait, Connor, this is America. We fix things. We fix things around the globe.
That's right, yes. But in some cases you try to fix things. they simply have to fix themselves. Uh-huh. I mean, the forces have to sort themselves out. As I put it, you can't oblige the Chinese to accept the First Amendment. The First Amendment is something that came out of your history, and it doesn't come out of Chinese history, and you can't put it in there.
So this calls for what? A certain political patience on the part of the United States and a drawing back from this fix-it mentality?
Yes. I would like to see... I mean, I respect the benevolent impulse. I mean, it really is one of the great things about America, and I don't want to be cynical about it. But I would like to see Americans, policymakers, above all, standing back and looking, not do we go in here, do we go in there, responding to images on television or whatnot and trying to patch up locally things that can't be patched. I would like to see policymakers looking at the world and saying, well, what's the really big problem? What's the biggest problem of all? The biggest problem of all is clearly the population explosion. You can see that if you look at South Africa, for example. South Africa is emerging from racism, but it's in its attempt to recover from the apartheid period, it's going to be hit by tremendous demographic problems, huge expanding youth with not nearly enough jobs for them. And this is ripping on all over the world and is among the causes of many of the conflicts. I would like the United States, and I think this may be happening, I would like to see the United States take a lead internationally in fighting the population explosion. Under the last three presidential terms, the United States at the international gatherings backed the Vatican, and the Vatican's policy is let it all rip, increase and multiply is to be taken literally. The more people you have, the better. I mean, this is what the Vatican still says, and it's dotty. I notice now that there is a preliminary conference going on for the Cairo Conference on Population in the autumn, and the American papers submitted for that are a great advance on anything before.
Are we still talking about nationalism here? Are we in what way do we make the connection between the benevolent forces of nationalism,
yes,
as you put it, and then the political opportunists?
Well, this is a way in which the American nation, which American nationalism in one of its aspects, in a very large aspect, is benevolent, but it is not making good use of its benevolence. It's getting trapped into all kinds of hole and corner situations, which it will be forced out of by other people's nationalism.
But you told us to wait and to be patient and to take essentially a hands-off policy.
Hands-off policy in relation to piecemeal interventions, but to be to look at the great, America is a global power, and if America doesn't look at the greatest global problem in the world, nobody else is going to be able to look at it effectively. Hitherto, under Reagan's two presidencies, under the Bush presidency, America has blocked efforts to put brakes on the population explosion. And I am very glad indeed to see that this administration is taking a different approach, and I hope it sticks to that approach, because many lobbyists will be trying to deflect it from that. Mm-hmm. But why I mention it in connection with nationalism is that this would be the right course for the benevolent side of American nationalism, which is powerful, to take. At the moment, it's kind of flying blind, bumping into situations in response to television. It's a lamentable spectacle, frankly. But I see in this initiative on the population matter a germ of hope.
Connor, in your experience as a diplomat and a scholar, a creative writer, how have you learned to come to terms with the term nationalism, to keep it distant from you, and yet to embrace it and understand it? It must be a deeply personal struggle.
Well, it's...
you're Irish.
It's a very important question for me, and I'm glad you asked it, because I'm now... I've just about finished a short book or long essay, which is called Ancestral Voices, Ritual Dances, and which is about religion and nationalism in Ireland. And I find this a disturbing, painful topic, and I've been trying to sort out my ideas concerning it.
Now, it's a big order, but how do you land on that question?
Well, I think what we have it's very odd, because if you visit the Republic of Ireland, leaving Northern Ireland slightly aside for the moment, you'll find I think you'll enjoy life there. You'll find you're among a good-humored, humorous people. They're not wild Serbs or Croats or whatever. But underneath, there is a territorial nationalist drive, and it's both religious and nationalistic, and it's directed against the Protestants of Northern Ireland. People talk as if they wanted agreement with them, but they never do. The push is always there, and the IRA are the cutting edge of something that's around in the national psyche more widely, even among people who at the conscious level deplore the IRA and would never vote for Sinn Féin. That's what I'm talking about, and I found it a very grim topic.
We are recording this conversation in the spring of 1994, Conor Cruise O'Brien. Do you find any reason at all to be realistically optimistic about the resolution of these problems? They are so ancient. They go so deep. How about it?
Very little. One must always hope. In this case, it's a convergence of religion and nationalism, which is territorially aggressive. That is what I see as most to be feared. But it does happen in history that religion and nationalism can converge at one moment, diverge at another. Also, nationalism, from being very inflamed, can subside to manageable proportions. I hope that something like that will happen with us in Ireland, but I am not seeing much signs of it at the time we're talking.
Conor Cruise O'Brien recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a study of the French Revolution and America's founding fathers. His books include Godland, a study of religion and nationalism, and The Great Melody, a thematic biography of the British statesman and philosopher Edmund Burke. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. For an audio tape of this discussion, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 718. That's program number 718. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the history of World War II, public monuments, and popular memory. My guest will be Claudia Kuntz, an historian who teaches at Duke University. Funding for this edition of Soundings came from the John M. Olin Foundation, with additional support from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thank you for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.